Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, July 10th, 2003. Today's session is entitled Peace Building, Breaking the Cycle of Revenge, Building the Path of Reconciliation, presented by Rick Brown, number BRR 2003-02. Let's listen in.
Brown, and I've been coming to Holden Village for about 12 years, on and off every other year or so. And I'm an organizational psychologist and do work in the area of conflict and conflict resolution domestically in both government, community, and nonprofit organizations, as well as some private companies. But about 2 years ago, I took a sabbatical, and as part of that sabbatical, I ended up taking a course, a two-week course, at a place called the School for International Training in Brattleboro, Vermont, on conflict transformation. And out of that experience, I met a number of people that have kind of taken me on a new path in my life. And that's part of what I'm going to be sharing today. That path is involved getting involved in international peace-building work through two venues. One is the Karuna Center for Peace-Building. And we're going to be showing you today a little bit of some slides of some of the work that the Karuna Center is involved in. And the second, and I'm on the board of directors of the Karuna Center. And the second is a program that emerged out of a set of relationships that I developed with a number of African peace builders who came to the same workshop in Brattleboro called Contact Africa. And Contact Africa is a project that involves building a cadre of peace builders on the African continent who are actively working in their communities around inter-ethnic, inter-communal, inter-religious conflict resolution and transformation. So today I'm going to be talking a little bit about that work and how that's occurred, and also giving you some opportunities to engage in some of the kinds of issues and questions that when we go out through our work with Karuna or our work at Contact, we go out into communities, what are the kinds of things that we put in front of people to help them move towards the path of reconciliation and away from the path of violence. So what I'd like to do is, I don't think anybody in the room here, except for Tracy, heard the story that I did at last, the story about the two wolves. Doesn't sound familiar. Good. So you hate to repeat things at sessions, but when you have a really good story to kind of set things off, it's good to use. And this is a story that actually I heard from a parent of one of the children in my daughter Emily's eighth grade class, who's now appearing at the door. And so she's heard this story now a couple of times, but I think it illustrates the notion of the path of reconciliation and what that means, and the struggle and the difficulty of that path in a very real way that I have seen and faced in working with people in some of these communities internationally. And the story goes like this. There's a grandfather, a Native American grandfather, who with his granddaughter has just escaped from an attack by the US military on their village. And this took place sometime in the 1880s or something. And he's sitting on a hill overlooking the devastation of his village. And the granddaughter is there with him. And they're silent for a moment. And finally, the granddaughter can't stand the silence anymore. She says, "Grandfather, you know, what are you feeling?" And the grandfather says, "I feel like I have two wolves who are battling in my heart and battling over my heart. And one wolf is the wolf of revenge and hate and fear. And the other wolf is the wolf of forgiveness and compassion and love." And the granddaughter says, "Well, these battling wolves, which wolf is going to win?" And the grandfather says, "The wolf that's going to win is the wolf that I feed." And this story is part of, I think, kind of states the obvious in some ways, but also the difficulty of the path of reconciliation, the path of forgiveness, in many of the situations that we face in the world today. Be they, you know, the situation following 9/11 in our own country, where we, in many ways, or at least our generation, my generation, for the first time, in a visceral way, stood on that hill and observed the devastation. But with that experience and that feeling is something that in other parts of the world, particularly in the world that suffered under colonial rule for many, many years from the European nations, and have had more recently to suffer under some of the effects of the sort of global world order. This is a day-to-day experience of choosing between the path of forgiveness and the path of violence and the path of revenge. And so the work that we're going to be talking about today is about how do you help people, and I'd be glad to talk about it because it's an important issue for me, how does a North American, a U.S. citizen, help people internationally, given where we're coming from, help people towards the path of peace and reconciliation? The Karuna Center for Peacebuilding is a nonprofit organization that is trying to do that. Emily, could you turn off the lights in the back there so we're going to move into the slides now for a little bit. And it was established about 10 years ago, like many nonprofits, out of the home of the executive director, Paula Green, and has expanded over time to now having a staff, full-time staff of 4 people with about 12 associates who are involved in the various projects and a board of directors of about 15. Karuna is a Hindu word for compassion. And that is sort of the centerpiece of the work that Karuna is involved in. I need to make a distinction in terms of when we talk about peace building. As you see on the left-hand corner where it says track one, and in the middle you can hardly read it, but it says diplomacy and peacekeeping. Most of the work that people think of when they think of peace building is work that's done at the governmental level, where the State Department of various, or the Foreign Ministry of various countries, are, or the UN or other international organizations, are working at the political and diplomatic level when conflicts either are brewing or break out to try to move towards some more peaceful resolution of those conflicts. That's what's known as track one peace building. What we're talking about today is what's known as track two peace building, which is working not with government officials necessarily, although there may be government officials involved, it's not in their role setting policy or implementing policy at a governmental level. What we're talking about at track two peace building is working at the level of civil, what we call civil society, meaning churches, educational institutions, nonprofit organizations, community organizations, working with sort of the indigenous organizations within communities to build a stronger fabric of peace and solving problems and working out issues at that level. This is a picture of Paula with a Bosnian Croat and Bosnian Serb in a workshop that was aimed at building through dialogue, discussion of what had happened in that country to come to some reconciliation. And I'll give you some more examples of that later on. So for just a second, we can turn the light back on for a second. One of the things that we start with in any of the kind of interventions that we might do, either in the CONTACT program or Karuna Center, is we start with the question of identity and who are the people here in this room. Because one of the things that we'll be talking about later, and actually we got to this at the end of Jim Hansen's workshop or session yesterday, in talking about Jesus' social ethic, is that one of the ways we end up, how is it that people do violence to each other? It seems like such a strange thing. And the way that people do violence to each other, one answer is the only way they can do that is if they forget that that other person is a human being just like you, with mothers and fathers and children and homes and lives and fears and concerns and needs. that we, the way we can do violence is to dehumanize people. That's if you look at any conflict situation, international conflict situation, there is a step at which, in going towards violence, at some point the other, the enemy, lost their humanness. And so part of what this work is about bringing the humanness of the other back into the room. So in doing this work, one of the questions and one of the things we do with people is to help people come to a place of identity. And one of the ways that we do that is we ask people this question. I hope this is the right one. Tell us about a time in your life when you felt like an outsider, when you felt marginalized and perhaps victimized because of a difference about who you are or who you were. What are some of the labels or stories or myths that would be put into you by those others? How did it make you feel about yourself? How did it make you feel about those who were seeing you this way? So this is a question we start out early on to get people, because what we have found is everybody at some point in their life has felt like the outsider, has felt their humanness being somehow lost and taken away. That's a way in which in some ways, the common experience of being marginalized is one of the ways that people start to see the humanness in the other. So let me just take a second, and if you're willing to engage in this a little bit, let's try it out for a second here. What are some of the ways or times in your life when you felt like you were the outsider? You were marginalized in some way, and maybe perhaps victimized. Anybody have any examples that come to mind when they read that question? Yeah, Mark.
Moved from the Twin Cities to the Red River Valley, and you often felt like I couldn't understand. They couldn't understand me.
And what were the specific? Was there any specific label or story or expectation or sense of who you were that you felt was being put on you that wasn't who you felt you were?
Yeah. I remember people telling me that I was autocratic because of the kind of leadership that I exercised.
Uh-huh.
And I was shocked.
Yes. The label didn't fit your experience yourself. How about somebody else? Any time when you felt like the outsider or in some kind of marginal role? Yeah.
I'm Julie.
Julie, yeah.
And I think it was after I graduated from college with a teaching credential, which is in, usually a female-dominated career. But at 21 and being a teacher in a small logging town where there was less emphasis on the role of females,
mm-hmm.
and being single and just struggling to develop an identity of who I thought I was. I was from the big city of Seattle, going to the little logging town of Kapalama, and it was very hard. I didn't last that very long. For that reason.
And you say it was very hard. What were some of the feelings that you had about yourself?
Just trying to be acknowledged for who I was in terms of personality, not what I looked like, not my age, not that I was single, not some other labels, but just get to know Julie for who Julie is and what she likes to do, whether it be her career or her interests. That was not anyone else's particular interest.
Right.
Who I was.
Who you were.
Yeah.
It's a very good example of that sense of marginalization.
Right.
And one more. Anybody else have an example? Yeah. Your name?
Lori Davidson. About 25 years ago, I used to work in construction.
Mm-hmm.
So the crew that I worked with, we were doing a lot of solar energy installations in homes and building greenhouses and things like that. It was fantastic. I mean, they were great, but we worked on a lot of union sites, and that's all men, and at the time, this was obviously a very, mid-70s, so late 70s, and so this was, it was pretty different for them to see a woman on site. So some of the guys there didn't take very kindly. to having a woman on the site. So, but the guys I worked with were just so incredible because it was very new age, very forward thinking, and so sometimes I felt like I had like 10 older brothers.
Yeah.
But it was a really interesting experience.
Yeah. And what were some of the feelings that you had towards those guys who had a heart, who did not take kindly?
Right. Well, I was a little afraid of them.
Mm-hmm.
I was never sure if, you know, I was never, there were times if I was working alone, some guys might come up and make comments or something.
Right.
And so I think I was, there was, well, I never felt overtly threatened. I think there was always just a little bit in the back of my head that, you know, violence could occur. I had a rock thrown at me one time. So there's the for women, I think violence against
right.
them is always kind of in the back of their heads, just
right.
going. And so I always, if I wasn't with one of the guys in my crew on these kinds of sites, then there would be that linger of, you know, just keep your eyes open
right.
and I'd be kind of super aware.
Now, I'd like you to imagine if you were, if we leave Colton Village and we're in a room, say, in Cape Town, South Africa, and there's a group of whites, blacks, and as they call them, colored South Africans, and we're having a discussion, and people are talking about what it felt like under apartheid, or what it felt like to be, to answer this question, and they started talking about their personal experiences of being an outsider. I want to get you get the sense of what some of the magic is of this process. Because in the process of doing that, when people walk in the room, they see black and that, and they see white, they see, and they put all kinds of ideas into their heads about who that person is. An hour or two later, they now hear about somebody who had a rock thrown at them. And they can imagine what it might have been like to have a rock thrown at them. And in these examples, sometimes much worse than just the image of having a rock thrown at you. This is part of the beginning of the opening of this kind of deep dialogue between people who have been in conflict, at war, afraid of each other. It's about rehumanizing those relationships and who those people are. Let me take you a little bit more into it.
Turn the lights back off. Oh, actually, you know what? I just realized this next slide is probably not readable. So I put it on the chalkboard, and I want to explain it real for a second. So you can leave it on. Sorry, Sierra.
One of the models that we use, and this is something we don't introduce to people in the first day or two, because we really want to get people out of their heads and into their experiences, their feelings, and their bodies early on in our workshops. But later, we give them this model to help them understand some of those feelings and see the patterns such that they can begin to take action at some point. And I'm sorry, my handwriting is lousy, but I'll walk you through it. This is what we call the cycles of violence and the cycle of reconciliation. And there is a departure point between the two. And I want to sort of walk you through the two cycles so you can get a sense of how that fits, maybe your own sense and own experience of how things work. We're going to start from the premise that at some point there's an act of aggression, a threat, a rock thrown at you, whatever. Somebody not treating you nicely, somebody, you know, putting a label on you, but some act of aggression. At that point, the first experience is one of injury, pain, use the word shock, and some cases denial. Some cases it's like, well, this didn't really happen. Sometimes they'll even go to that point. At that point is the critical question, in some ways, about where do you end up? Do you perpetuate the cycle of violence, or do you perpetuate the cycle towards forgiveness and reconciliation? The typical path is there's a realization of loss of safety, loss of sense of identity, loss of security of some form or another. And if it continues and that loss does not dealt with in some effective or meaningful way, often what will happen is that there'll be a suppression of the grief associated with that loss or the fear associated with that loss. That will then move into anger, because when we suppress the primary emotion, we often go to the secondary emotion that many of us have, which is anger, and we ask the question, why me? Which often will then turn into the desire for revenge. Now, this is a piece that I talked about last time and really is the point at which a lot of our work at the Kruna Center in Pontiac is focused in post-conflict situations, which is that in order to be able to move towards an act of revenge as opposed to a thought for revenge, we need to create a myth or a story about the correct conflict history. We need to turn that person who did that harm, or maybe it wasn't even that person, but those people, and create a story that says there's something about them that deserves revenge. There's something about them that is evil, that is bad. We need to dehumanize them in order to then go to an act of justified aggression. And this is where we depart from, you know, this notion of a just war, because a just war is always just based on some story or some rationale that has been created that at some point or another says these people deserve violence against them. Now you can, I'm not going to get into the whole ethics and morality question, is that true or not true, but in terms of the behavioral and psychological cycle that gets created, this is sort of the path of revenge. Now, there is another option. There is another path. And in fact, the way this is supposed to be set up is at any point along this cycle of revenge and violence and perpetual aggression, there could be a departure if the proper interventions were able to come into place. But let's go through the cycle so you can see how that might occur. So we're back at that point of there's aggression. In this case now it's justified aggression, right? Because we've created this story. Muslims are going to take over our world. The Bosnian Muslims are going to ally with the Arab world and they're going to attack us from all sides and Serbia will never exist, et cetera, et cetera. So we better kill them first. And so there's that injury, that pain. What if it went towards mourning and the expression of grief, towards acceptance of loss and the confronting of the fears? Put it out on the table. We're afraid that this violence is going to continue. At that point, the question is, do we go to anger, why me, or do we go down the path of saying, rehumanizing the enemy and saying, well, why did they do this? What is it about them? What is going on with them that they would go into violence? At that point, you can go then to say, maybe there is something that happened to them that got them to such a point that they felt some need to act in an aggressive way. I can go this cycle, and I know where it's going to lead, but perhaps I can choose to forgive, to take the risk of trying to end the cycle. I really like the way that Jim yesterday talked about, you know, the turning the other cheek. You know, this is this act of courage right here, of saying, the courage to, instead of going the path of dehumanizing my enemy by doing violence against them, I'm going to work to rehumanize them by turning my cheek such that they have to recognize the humanness in me. And therefore, perhaps experience that at that moment, this is a human interaction. This is not about me as some, you know, single mom or, you know, Wiggins liver or it's a good time, autocratic Norwegian or whatever. This is another human being. This is this person. And then that becomes a time for doing the negotiation of solutions, problem solving, and rewriting the history, looking at the history in a deep way and saying, let's really take a look at what happened that led up to this act of aggression. in a deep way. And so in Africa, when we look at the conflicts in places like Rwanda and Burundi, or the Ivory Coast more recently, and we come to find that there was not any particular biological or genetic enmity between these tribes, but there was a long history of European powers using tribes to divide and conquer in order to get political and military advantage on behalf of European interests. Then you come to understand that there's a different story about why these tribes are in conflict than the one that we understand here, or they even understand there, because they lost that history, because the history has been written by the victors. And so you then move towards, from that history, establishing justice, meaning some cases you have to have the international courts, or in the case of South Africa, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, where people had to, in a very formal way, come and talk about what they did publicly. In this case, not just the white nationalists, but also some of the members of the revolutionary members of the ANC and the PAC, who also did violence, and talked about what they did, and asked for forgiveness, and had to make reparation, such that you get to the point of reconciliation. Okay, so that's the reconciliation cycle. The work that the Karuna Center is involved in is mostly, right now, projects here and here, okay, where, sort of on this side, the injury and the shock has occurred, the mourning in many cases, and people are sort of on this phase of the cycle where they're still in grief. We go into situations like Bosnia, Kosovo, Macedonia, Sri Lanka, and now Rwanda, and actually in a situation in India where a conflict has occurred, hurt has happened, aggression has existed, and we are asked by groups that want to see if they can move from this path to this path at about this point. Okay, and that's what we're going to be talking about a little bit, some of those examples and how we move people from this path to this path at this point in the cycle. Okay. Questions about this, or comments or reflections? Yeah.
Is this written in a book anywhere, or is this sort of Karuna Center's own business?
This version of it, which is stands on the shoulders of many others, yeah, has not been written in a book, but I've got a CD, and I can, if you've got a laptop, I can download it, or I can give it. If anyone wants to get any of the materials that I show here, give me your email address, and I can email the stuff, so you can have it that way. Yeah.
Frank, I would think rehumanizing the enemy is a really complicated entity.
Yeah.
And so, are you going to talk about how you break that part down?
That is really tough. And what, you know, this is just one exercise that I talk about, because people talking about the experience of being another. That's one. Doing deep, the example I just gave of doing deep, what we call deep conflict analysis, where we take a look at, with the two sides in the room, or three in many cases, Sri Lanka got the Muslims, the Tamils, and the Sinhalese, go back and look at the history of that conflict and start to see the various actors that were involved and what the various interests were and how the various power dynamics were exercised, that people come to see these were real human beings dealing with real forces that, you know, were different than the story we might be left with today.
So it's not a matter of just rationalizing out of that. You have to actually go back and do the research.
That's right. And I'm telling you, in the intellectual, when we do it in actual workshops, in some cases we're talking about the history of a particular village. Yeah. You know, and this family did this 75 years ago. Okay, and that Muslim family did this to that Serb family, and then that Serb family did that, and that Croat family got caught in the crossfire, and really recreating and going back through that history and coming to terms with it in a very personal way. So it's not just the political, economic history. Sometimes it's the family histories of a community.
Rick, who tells the history? Do the people that are engaged in the workshop, or do the leaders? I mean, where does the history come from? The people in the room?
It's a combination. Uh-huh. So for example, in our work, we did a workshop in West Africa. One of our leaders, our teachers, is a man who teaches at Eastern Mennonite University, but he's an Eritrean professor of peace studies, and he's an expert on the history of conflict in West Africa. So he had factual information about particular conflicts and could present them. But there, you know, one of the precepts when you go into a room with people in this kind of work is all the information that's needed is in the room. The issue is how do you create an environment where you can get that information, which is not just facts, but feelings, onto the table so that people can see things as they were and are versus the myths and the labels, get past those concepts. So it's a combination. Yeah.
How does that compare to what they tried to do in South Africa? And was that successful or not? I don't hear much about it after the fact.
I'm not an expert on the South African experience, but I do know a little bit because I was in Cape Town in last November and met with some representatives who had been involved in the TRC, that's the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which was the model that many other countries are using today to try to sort out these things. But there's many, many other things that are going on in South Africa other than that TRC. So, and I can give you other examples if you're interested. Yeah.
I don't know if this is getting too off-track, so you don't even have to answer it if you don't want to. But I'm wondering what you think, I'm looking at your little cycle on the board. Like, with Native American issues here and like white folks, or with slavery and white folks, how does this model translate when the injustice or the most horrible part of all of this is centuries old and you have to dig so deep to get at that stuff and it's easier for people to shirk responsibility for what they were involved in? Do you see any connections there, how the same model could be used?
Well, I think it can, and I think that one of the best points of evidence is that when you talk to people in Bosnia, and one of the people that I've gotten to know is a imam, a young man, actually, you know, in his 20s, he's an imam, but he's a Bosnian Muslim, and when they talk in Bosnia about the roots of the conflict there, people sit and talk about what happened in 1400. So they're working those issues in that context. But I think Peter's point last night is really critical, which is that you don't necessarily have to recapitulate and recreate all the injustices from all the years, because the fact of the matter is, there's plenty going on today in terms of...
So you could get at that history through the stuff that's going on right now.
Right. I mean, the reason to do the history is not... I want to be clear. It's not about, well, see... It's you guys who did it. It's not doing the history for the purposes of some kind of, you know, judicial process of saying who is right and who is wrong. It's to do the history for the purpose of recognizing these. This is not about these foreign characters in a movie. Mm-hmm. This is about real people who had real lives and real experiences, real pains and real hurts. So it's about the rehumanization of the thing versus... Which is the work that Peter did last night in the sermon of just sort of talking about his experience of these different people looking at him in different ways.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the work of rehumanizing what it's. I walked out of the room going, I've had different people look at me, and that Peter and I are connected. We've had that same experience, and I know about the privilege. I have a deeper sense of the privilege that my white skin carries me, even though I have many other parts of who I am that I bring into a situation. So the recapitulating the conflict history is not to do judge right or wrong, but to rather rehumanize the people, how that history affects the people as they sit in the room today, who have to make a choice of which path they're going to go down. And to finish the question over here, the TRC, the judgment that I came away with from people, you know, good critical thinking people that I met in South Africa, the TRC was good to the extent that for the first time that a lot of people know in human history, you had a revolution, a real revolution, where there was not any meaningful blood and there was not a bearing of what happened. People talked about what happened. For those of you who don't know about it, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was set up by the government to provide an avenue for people who had been victimized by the white government for many years under apartheid to have their grievances heard and heard in public, and to have the people who perpetuated the violence against them have to sit and hear them tell their grievances, and have those people who perpetuated that violence have to the extent that they could, ask for forgiveness and then be forgiven in a public way. We're talking about over 60,000 witnesses who came before various commissions in public settings that were televised, put on the radio, 60,000 people. Now, 60,000 represents an absolute minuscule percentage of the people who were actually victimized. But it was a two-year process. The overall process was an eight-year process in terms of all the things that happened out of it, reports that were written, things that people had to do to repair, et cetera, et cetera. But it was the first time in history that we know of where a country as a whole went through this kind of public witness process of what had happened. Now, the judgment of most people is that it was a good experience from the standpoint of that kind of public witnessing and discussion. What it did not do, in many cases, it did not, the accountability question is still up in the air. There are a lot of people who got off in ways that they may have been forgiven, they may have felt bad, etc. There's still some accountability issues. For example, and it's not just on the side of the whites. I have a very close friend who was a freedom fighter, meaning he was a guerrilla, and he shot people, and he did things that he will not tell me that were pretty violent. On the side of the quote unquote freedom fighters, and in his own, he was not part of the ruling government, the African National Congress. He's part of the Pan-African Congress. And they disagreed with the policy of the ANC to just do this public declaration piece and not have punishment. Because he said, I should be punished. There are things that I did that I should be punished for. And I'm not going to be. So the point is, it was successful at one level, and there are things that are still left open. And there's still the issue of the economic injustices that continue in South Africa, although changes are being made. So it's a very complicated question. Okay, let's move into just some of these other examples. Thanks, Sam. Let's get this out of the way. Hello?
Where'd the picture go?
Hello? Please come back.
Just turned off.
Is there a pause thing on that?
Yeah, it seems to be automatic.
It just shut off.
It was on too long.
Went to a new screen, didn't it?
Went to sleep.
Isn't it fun when this kind of thing happens? let's see.
Maybe you guys start from the beginning, turning it on and off.
Okay, well, we're gonna turn the lights back on. That's not gonna work. This technology has been a little bit of
a challenge.
Let me either they're coming on at once, but let me. I'd like you to be able to see the pictures of some of these people, but I can tell their story without the pictures. I want to tell. Let me start with Sri Lanka. Kruta Center was. Invited into Sri Lanka about 18 months ago. Now, for those of you who aren't familiar, there's been about a 22-year civil war within the country of Sri Lanka, which is just south of India, primarily between the Tamils, who are Hindu religious folks, and the Sinhalese, the ruling government, the Buddhist government. And this is kind of an irony to the Buddhist government that's at war with people, but that's the point. It can happen anywhere. Interestingly, the Track 1 work that's been going on, that governmental level work, has primarily been led by Norway. Norway has been one of the leaders in taking a Track 1 approach that is a conflict transformation model. And they basically brokered a ceasefire about 2 years ago. It went on, it went off, went on, went off. Somewhere in that period, though, we were invited in to work with a group of civil society leaders, that same mix of government. In one case, we had a couple of military folks, and we never had anybody in our workshops who were military before, but in this particular case, they were people who were involved in trying to do peacekeeping, the notion of military as peace officers, and so it kind of worked. And we just did, and in that training, we had 5 days with the Tamil representatives, and we had 5 days with the Sinhalese representatives, and we had 1 day where they were together, because they were not at a place at that time where bringing them together much more than that was going to be that helpful. And mostly what we did with them is this kind of sensitivity building kinds of stuff,
humanization kind of stuff.
We were, with in this particular case, the board of directors of the Korean Center, we decided to use some of our reserve funds to pay for this workshop because they didn't have any money to do this. There was a couple people who invited us there. They didn't have any money to get us there. We had people donate airline miles to get our trainers over there. We had, and the Korean Center put some money in to pay for the land costs and so forth, on the hope that this would be the first step of a number of other things. About 8 months later, after the ceasefire had been, you know, enforced for enough time that there was some security around it, we were invited back in, and we did a workshop this. This spring, and there were, now we also had, in this case, Muslim representatives, because there's also a small minority community there. And that workshop, it was the opposite. We had 1 day of people apart and 7 days of people together working. And by the end of those 7 days, this group of people had formed an organization that was basically saying, we are committed to taking this work out into the country. And they are now in the process of raising money themselves from governments, from foundations, and hopefully through the Korea Center, private donations, and so forth, to train the trainer and eventually begin going out and doing these kinds of dialogue processes in different communities in the various parts of Sri Lanka.
I think if you restart, this thing is restarted now.
Yeah.
If you restart your program, it might.
Okay. Well, I'll do
time,
that.
Do you want me to do it?
No, I can do it real quick, and then we can just, if we want to.
I think it'll come back on again.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. So we'll see what happens.
It'll take a minute if it does work. The second example I want to give is one in Rwanda. We did a training in Goma, which was an area actually in the Congo, across the border from Rwanda, in 1999, in the Goma refugee camp, the big camp that had like 1 million people, who were refugees from the various wars in that lakes region. And the third day in, and this was a camp that was run by the UN, but it was sort of controlled by various military factions. And we pissed off somebody after about 3 or 4 days and were kicked out. And which, you know, that happens.
That was where?
Goma, which is right on the border with Rwanda and the Congo.
Okay.
And these camps, I mean, these are real hellhole. I mean, this is, you know, like they.
Yeah.
Real hellhole. But we had been able to get a group of Hutus and Tutsis who were interested in working towards reconciliation. Those are the two groups that had been in conflict in Rwanda, to actually sit down and talk. And this threatened some of the Tutsis, you know, and in other parts of the camp, and they didn't like that, and so we got kicked out.
How do you deal with the language?
This is a really critical piece. We hire translators who then become the seeds of leadership for the future. So for example, in this project in Sri Lanka, the two translators we had were actually two young women, a Tamil and Sinhalese women, who were in the contact program in Brattleboro that I went to, that I mentioned 2 years ago. They had come to the U.S. for training, and they were the ones who invited us over. And they were the translators, and now they are also part of the leadership of this group that has formed its own NGO, is raising money, and is starting to do these workshops. So, know, they, we will come back in to provide additional support, but the model is a bootstraps model. The translators are the people who, in many cases, are the people who become, that's the train trainer part of it. Let me see if we can get some pictures of some of these folks so you can get a more of a flavor of what this is about. Go to, we'll give you a little bit of a Sri Lanka piece. Okay, there's Sri Lanka. So yeah, this is one of the military guys who was involved in that first training. And it's hard to tell in this picture here, but this is a chart pad. This is part of the conflict analysis. This is a chart that they did where they did kind of analysis. There's in each piece here, there's Muslim, Hindi, and Sinhalese. And the scripts are great if you can see it. It's kind of fun. Anyway.
So when they're in military uniform, does that kind of change the dynamics of the conversation? Is there in certain roles? Or?
You know, part of our work is early on to get people out of the label of who they look like to who they are. And we do a lot of work in the early days of, you know, so Nassim became, you know, a father of three children and you know, and why he joined the military and, you know, why, you know, as a peace officer. And so people saw behind the uniform. You can see the woman on the left working with our cycle of violence and reconciliation model there. And let's see. What we got next here? And here's a group sort of doing some work on the ground. We've got a Muslim man over here, and two Tamils and a Sinhalese. Tamil, Sinhalese. Okay, so it gives you a little bit of flavor of who the people are. Let me just go for a second to finish the story of Rwanda. This is a picture of the camp when we first came there. And a million people living in this kind of condition. And still, there are a lot there now. So, this is the part I wanted to get to. So we were only there for 3 or 4 days in 1999. And then we were invited back after we did this Contact Africa project. We had some, in West Africa, about a year and a half ago, we had some people, we've maintained contacts, and we had some people who came from Rwanda to the workshop that we did in Accra. And when we say they came, we raised the money to enable them to come to the location, a lot cheaper than bringing them to Brattleboro, Vermont. And these were people who, out of that 3-4 day workshop, both Hutus and Tutsis, who had formed their own project and organization in the camp. And by basically 2 years later, they were doing reconciliation workshops, problem solving workshops, getting Hutus and Tutsis together to cooperate in a camp that had been very much divided. And that's not to say that, you know, there were still many forces at play that were still trying to use divide and conquer. But these people stood up and put together a structure and an organization that enabled them to continue to push this path of peace. That's what they were committed to. And I don't. This says it's French, Association pour la Promotion à la Non-Violence. Somebody who speaks French can probably pronounce that better, but that's the organization. So that was a real, I mean, and we had lost contact with them for a long time, and so to have this emerge out of just that small piece was very gratifying, as you can imagine. And here, this is a workshop, this is a picture that they sent us of a workshop that they were doing
with Hutus, with a group of Hutus. And this is one of the things we often will do to get people into their feelings about stuff is to have them actually do sort of, I don't know if you've ever heard of sculpting, where you use you use your body to illustrate what it feels like to be in a particular conflict situation. And so this is just an example of that. And a big part of the work in the camps in Rwanda and Burundi, here's a picture of a church service that the this group Nonviolence Pour La, anyway, they are associated with the church there, with
Association
the church group there
for the Promotion of Nonviolence.
Thank you.
Okay,
there you
that
go.
Would be the English.
That would be the English. Yeah.
Nonviolence for Peace and Unity.
Yeah, it says on
board. Let me just get to this last one here. One of the things that we've done a lot with Contact Africa is problem solve with people who are working in refugee camps, because one of the ways that the violence is perpetuated, particularly against women, is that the refugees of these various conflicts are stuck across the border from their homes, and they're afraid to go home. And usually, in most cases, at least from our experience, it's the men who are most afraid of going home. The women really want to go home because it's the women who are most vulnerable in these camps. The kind of things that they're, because the law and order, the basic structure, community structure, you know, forces of law and order are not very effective in the camps. So they want to get out of there as quickly as possible. And so one of our people who's been through our peacebuilding trainings in Ghana and then in Cape Town, he actually works for CARE as an agricultural advisor in Burundi, but that's his cover for basically doing peace building work. And what the project he set up is that every about 1 week a month, he sneaks over the border from Burundi into Tanzania and brings with him a mixed group of women who he has been working with, of both Hutus and Tutsis, to the camps in Burundi. Actually, they go to the sort of demilitarized zone, the sort of no man's land, a woman's land. And he does groups, reconciliation groups, in the bush, basically. When women from the camps sneak out of the camps, they know about this, they come to the area, they meet people, and when he tries to bring together are villagers who lived together peaceably before the conflict, they come together and they talk about what is it going to take to get their men to be willing to join back together. And it's been a very successful model, such that the UN is now funding him to do this officially. He did it for about a year unofficially, and now he's getting funding to do it. The last story I do want to tell is the Bosnian story, real quick. And I'm going to just jump to that slide, which is 45. It's what we call our Project Diacom, and this is this young man, Behedin, who we mentioned before. And the story there is that we went into Bosnia, to a town called Tetovo, and let me just tell you Behedin's story. Now I'll kind of give you the sense of the project. Behedin was 16 years old when one day his sister came running down the street into his home in a village that had Serbs and Muslims and Croats living together peaceably for many, many generations, saying that Serb soldiers were coming down the road and they were going to be there in 15 minutes and we have to get out of here. And Behedin's mom and sister, immediately, basically, with nothing, you know, a bag of food, basically left. The father refused to leave, and he stayed behind. Mm-hmm. Eventually, Behedin ended up in a camp, and was in that camp for, I think, about 2.5 years while the war raged on and so forth. And
what kind of camp? Like a prisoner of war camp?
Yeah,
basically a prisoner of war camp.
And he became a teacher while he was in the camp as an older young man. And about
9 months into the camp, their father showed up one day, alive, but to tell the story, which is that basically anybody who had been left there had been killed. He had hidden and had been able to escape, but he had been on the run for that time. He probably had joined up with partisans or something. But the point is that anybody who had been left behind and killed. Eventually, when they came back to this village of about 5,000 people, about 1,000 had been killed, because the others had escaped. After getting out of the camps and after the Dayton Peace Accords, they went back to their village and, you know, buried their dead, and you know, they had to live. This was a village that they had to live together with the people who they had been. I mean, again, the soldiers who came were not necessarily the ones who were of their village, okay? But they had to live together. And they had been, you know, in the repatriation back to the village, they had various groups come through saying you need to forgive and forget and move on. That had been the message. And this was something that Vahedon said, you know, it was very hard for me to accept. Given, you know, how could I forget when all around me were empty houses, bombed out houses, and graveyards of my friends who had been killed. He went back to school, got his teaching credential, became a teacher, and one day his principal said, the faculty have selected you to go to this workshop being put on something called the Karuna Center. And this is now about 5 years ago. I said, I don't want to go to the, you know, I've been through all that in the camps, you know. No, you're the youngest teacher, you have to go. You're the bottom of the totem pole. And he went to the workshop where our message was, it's not about forgive and forget. It's about remember, know what happened, face the loss, face what happened, talk about it, and come to terms with it with the other, and remember. But the other part of the cycle is we've got to change the story. We've got to rewrite the history. We've got to establish justice. So as John Lederach puts it, John Paul Lederach, and there's a book by him in the Holden Bookstore, which is great, forgive, remember, and change. The message is not forgive and forget, it's forgive, remember, and change. And eventually, you know, this inspired Vahedon to the point where he now, 5 years of this of us being there, he now has an NGO that not only is continuing to do this work in his town, but in 5 other towns in his surrounding region. He's back there and has that set up. So that's, again, another example of, you know, the kind of personal transformation that occurs. I mean, he went from being this very angry, you know, hurt person to leading projects themselves in reconciliation. The last thing before, you know, the bell's going to ring, can you turn the lights back on, honey? Before the bell rings, is the issue of, so, what does this mean for us today? What's our response? And I wanted to just share with you my response to coming in contact with this way of looking at international conflict, and see if it fits some of what you might think. I mean, number one, what I do, wherever I go, places like this, is try to build awareness that there is this other way, that the package that we're being sold by our current administration, and it's sort of, in some ways, we all believe in some way, that, you know, there are these conflicts out there that there's just, they're endless. There is only the cycle of aggression and violence. There really is no alternative. It just won't happen. And part of what I'm trying to do in my life is build awareness that, no, there is an alternative. You can move cycles of violence towards a path of reconciliation. Second is to practice peace building in your own life, and be that in domestic issues, as Kelly was talking about, you know, about the issues we're facing here, but on a more personal level. One of the basic principles of the dialogue that we do, the work that we do, is a notion of dialogue versus debate. That we're not talking about establishing who's right and wrong, which is what debate's about. Yeah. What we're really trying to do is develop understanding and rehumanization of the other so that we can work with them. And so in engaging in discussions around conflict or dealing with conflict, wherever I'm at, I try to listen for understanding, not for response. Suspend judgment, try others' ideas on a precise. And key, practice empathy. Empathy. Find the place of feeling connection in the other. The place of fear, the place of hurt, the place of being marginalized, whatever it is. When you're in a situation where you're, you know, somebody's doing something that's hurtful to you, what, you know, what is that showing you about the hurt in that other person? Can you move to that? So practicing peace building. Then there's political action. And two issues I kind of named that you want to think about right now is, at the political levels, Denis Kucinich, who's running for president, you know, whatever that means, has put a proposal out in Congress to establish a Department of Peace, which would be a U.S. agency like what we referred to with Norway, whose primary role is to promote a peaceful resolution of conflict by entertaining both a little bit of track one, but mostly track two type interventions in various hotspots around the world. So take a look at the Department of Peace proposal. There is, in fact, a United States Institute for Peace, USIP. They actually funded the last 3 years of our Project DIACOM in Bosnia. And based on the success of both that project and the Contact Africa project, the U.S. Agency for International Development has taken the report that came out of this and our work in those areas and is now going to be funding a Contact Middle East project and a Contact Macedonia project. This is a place where a U.S. government, in fact, is putting money into this Track 2 kind of work. So talk to your congresspeople about continuing funding for USIP. Doing volunteer work. The work that I'm doing is my particular way of trying to support the peace-building movement internationally. There are many others. The Lutheran Peace Fellowship, which is based in Seattle, is a really good organization. So, you know, given the Lutheran connection here, I would check out some of the things that they're doing. But there are other organizations that you might want to check into and do some volunteering with. And then the other big thing I have to say always is money. The fact of the matter is that this is a new field. The peace-building field is very new. There are really no major foundations, no philanthropic organizations that are dedicated to funding this kind of work. The Hewlett Foundation used to be, a year and a half ago with the drop in the price of Hewlett stock, they basically stopped funding any new projects. They were the real light in the philanthropy world. And they were making progress in getting other foundations to start looking at proposals from organizations like Karuna. I mean, not just Karuna, but organizations like it around the world that were doing this work. They've shut down for at least another 2 or 3 years. So these organizations are very much dependent on private money because, again, I mean, the money, there is some money from the U.S. Institute for Peace. There's very little from anywhere else. So if there's any organization, you know, if you feel a need to donate money, it's really important right now. For this Contact Africa project, that was purely up until recently when USAID, United States Agency for International Development, has decided to provide funding for that project. But the first 2 years of it was all private donations. And think of the people who put their money into that and now know that that's like venture capital has resulted in this much larger money coming in. So it's for those of us who kind of think in those economic ways, it's really kind of fun. But it's a way of getting back, not just giving. Because, you know, I know that that's sort of the selling thing, but the number of people who I have approached around this work who feel, you know, this sense of hope because they recognize that there is something else that's possible out there. It's been really neat to have those relationships with folks. So you have to think about what your response is. I mean, one response is, okay, now I know about it, and I'm going off. I would really challenge you to think about, this is the future, to me, of our world. If we can't figure out how to move from the cycle of violence as a total world towards the path of reconciliation, one of these situations is not going to be controlled. It's going to get out of control. And maybe we're in there already, and maybe it's more urgent than that, but I just happen to think that this is the most important work we can be doing right now because we're so vulnerable. And since there is a path, I encourage you to do whatever you can to move people to act on that. So, any final questions or reflections?
Are you aware of any groups working with any success in the Middle East? on this, in this venue.
Yeah, we are, you know, Karuna, we're going to be there soon. Mm-hmm. Karuna Center is going to be there soon. I mean, we have contacts there. We've not been able to go there for the last couple of years. We used to have people who came to Brattleboro, but they couldn't get visas the last 2 years. Mm-hmm. Okay. But the main organization in the Middle East that I would take a look at, that I can just off the top of my head say, is known as the Abraham Fund. And this is an organization that is governed by both Palestinians and Israelis, and that both does work itself in this reconciliation work and funds, is a channel for funding grassroots organizations in Palestine and in Israel that are working on this kind of work. There are many other organizations. That's just the one that off the top. And they're at abrahamfund.org, or just Google on them. Yeah.
Is this work primarily with adults, or is there a movement to work with children or young adults?
Yeah. The contact program actually has conducted peace camps for kids from both the Holy Land, Palestine and Israel, Northern Ireland, Cyprus, Macedonia, for the last 4 or 5 years. This, we haven't been able to do the peace camp for Palestinian Israelis, as I said, for the last 2 years because we can't get visas for Palestinians. And there are many other organizations who do that same kind of thing. But I'm just saying, in terms of the contact program, we do those camps every year. This summer there's going to be a Macedonian one because Karuna is doing a major project in Macedonia now, you know, the conflict between the Albanians and the Macedonians. In many ways, that's you know, the Karuna Center model, I didn't get into that slide, is we're really moving towards working with educators as our target group, then having those educators then moving into working with their students. And then the students and the educators working together. Just a quick example is we did do a workshop in Macedonia in the fall that was a joint adult youth workshop. And one of the actions the youth decided to take after the workshop was to every Wednesday night, as a joint group of Albanians and Macedonians, meet at cafes on the Albanian side of the town and the Macedonian side of town, which was a scandal, right? I mean, for the first time in, you know, 50 years, there were Albanian youth sitting in a Macedonian cafe, and then the next week, Macedonian youth sitting in an Albanian cafe, which is great, you know, for teenagers, right? It's like, they're thumbing their nose at their parents, and they're doing peace building. it's a win-win. So, you know, it was this core group of students who went through the training, and now there's like 50, 75, I mean, they get a lot of kids every night, you know, I mean, every week doing this thing. So, again, it's and the leverage effect there is obviously really large. So, that's an important part. Any other questions or reflections? Okay. I do have here a couple other resources I just would mention, and there's this nice brochure in the resource room. Those of you don't know where the resource room is, just around the corner over here. It took me 4 years to be at Holden to discover it. And there's a whole section on peace materials. They have a brochure on 24 ways for students to work for peace that's put out by the Lutheran Peace Fellowship. And again, that's their website. The Fellowship of Reconciliation magazine journal is a great journal for kind of tracking what are some of the things that are going on around the world. There's and great articles in there. In the resource room, there's also, FOR did a booklet celebrating the Decade for a Culture of Peace and Nonviolence. It has all kinds of suggestions. If these aren't the kind of responses that work for you, all kinds of suggestions of things that you could get involved in or get kids involved in, particularly as a student material. There's all kinds of great stuff in here. That you can do with youth groups, at your church, or if you're an educator at schools. And this book, Transforming Violence, is in the resource room. It's not in the bookstore, but it has some great articles about the current status of the kind of this model. But they're in the bookstore. John Lederach's book, if it hasn't been sold out already, you should really get that one if you want to read more about it. He's really sort of one of the forefathers of this movement, and he writes within a very Christian tradition. So those who like that kind of stuff, it's really very well done. So I'll let you go. Thanks for coming.